but newspress.com.
Good afternoon and welcome to another edition of AHA Presents About Education. I'm Neil Kreisel and I'm your host every week right here on AM 1290, repeated at 10, and on Saturdays at 4. We're brought to you by Deckers, makers of Uggs and Hokas, Pierre LaFon, Wendy Foster, offering fine clothes, good food, and vintage wines, Montecito Bank and Trust, proudly serving our communities and their financial needs for over 40 years, Habitat for Humanity, building strength, stability, and self-reliance through shelter, and CSU Channel Islands. No matter which of their academic programs you choose, you will be at the center of your educational experience. Welcome, everybody, and a happy Thanksgiving. We're here today with Peta Liam, a professor at UCSB in political science. Welcome.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you for being here. And actually, thank you for being here on a really relevant date. One of the many publications that you, one of the many books that you've written was called Race, Gender, and Political Leadership in the 21st Century. And today, that couldn't be more relevant. What's going on in the world today is really unbelievable in terms of power struggles, in terms of women finally asserting their right to be treated as equals.
Right.
So you were prescient in spending the last 30 years becoming a scholar in this area.
Exactly, yeah. Well, this book was, the idea of this book was actually more than 20 years ago. So we were already, you know, foreseeing what's going to come. Actually, of course, this is actually under the women's, our concern was women's underrepresentation, particularly people of color, men and women of color. And of course, you know, given the kind of gendered underrepresentation in the U.S. political system, so women of color seem to be actually at the far low side, actually, of the representation issue and political participation issue in general. And so that's the essence of our book, but also that we try to also look at not just, you know, black women, but also Latina women, Asian American women, to even cover the Native American or American Indian woman, and of course their male counterpart. And so that was, therefore, we claim that this book is actually the nation's first in terms of its comprehensiveness and its diverse attention and to people's different origin and who are situated actually at the intersection of race and gender. Gender, and to some extent, ethnicity and nativity as well.
And when you say gender, do you include in the LGBT community? Is that part of that of your focus, or is it gender meaning just male, female?
Actually, it's only about male and female. We wish we could have even more foresight about that. Uh-huh. And we actually had a survey, and you know, a lot of time these personal identity, they don't really, you know, unlike today, a lot of time they don't, sometimes they want to hide it rather than to make it more, so obviously, you know, particularly on a website. And so we had to go through a survey, a telephone survey actually, to try to get, and one of our questions indeed is about identity, sexual identity, and of course, gender and other kind of identity. And very, very few, a single-digit number out of over 1,200 elected officials that actually answered that. So I guess if that could be an indicator, there was a very small percentage of the people of color who served the nation's elected positions at all levels, right? Local, state, and local offices.
And this book was written, in 2001, received an award in 2002. Is that true?
Actually, that was my other book.
Oh, that was your other book.
So this book is actually quite new. Oh. It was only published about a year ago. And then I guess you guys noticed it because we received some award. Mm. So it's a fairly new book, even if the idea of it is starting long. Actually starting, you know, there was a year called the Year of Woman. I don't know how many people remember that. It was actually in 1992. Right.
I'm too young to remember.
No problem with me. Okay, but you know, it's also very relevant today because at that time, why do we even have the Year of Woman? It's because prior to that, there was a Supreme Court nominee hearing with Thomas, African-American male, Clarence Thomas, and currently, of course, he's already Supreme Court Justice, and he was accused of being sexually harassing one of his staff.
Anita Hill.
Anita Hill, yeah. So, yes, at that time, of course, even if Anita Hill would claim that, you know, I'm so wronged, and, you know, because of my race and gender, that people do not, you know, people actually believe more in an African-American male when he claimed racism, right? He said this is high-tech racism when people, when there's a hearing and people try to grill him in terms of, I don't know, what did you actually do it or not? Women were very angry that somehow, why, because you're male, even if you were African-American male, the people believe you more. And therefore, there was a surge of the woman becoming candidate and then becoming elected into the National Congress, as well as actually also state houses and other, you know, the local positions. Almost like similar, in a way, similar to the kind of people were angry, people were frustrated, and then people want to do something for themselves. I'm talking about women, right? American women of all colors, all origins. And they came out and just, you know, in this 2017 election, people, because of their frustration with what happened in 2016. And therefore, we see a surge of women candidates coming on to the floor. And then, of course, a number of them, people with diverse, very diverse background, including sexuality, right? The nation's very first group of, you know, transgender men and women got into the offices. Of course, Asian Americans, you know, make some history, and other Latinos as well.
25 years have gone by since Anita Hill was not believed by everyone. Given what's going on the last few weeks, the last few months, do you think things would be different today?
I would say that's a good question, but kind of difficult to answer. And I feel that, you know, the answer it's actually, even if I can see the number, I can show you the numbers. There's so many people, and it seems like, you know, that in Hollywood or in a very prominent position, white woman, and it seemed like white women were, you know, complaining about being sexually harassed, and somehow you see, you know, some guys got fired and whatever. But as when you talk about where are the women of color in this, I guess today we actually have some, you know, congresswoman and congressmen, the African American, and so this is still a phenomenon that is ongoing. And whether or not you're going to see a sea change or not, it really depends on whether or not it could be trickle up into an institutional change. Unless you actually have people elected or appointed to the leadership who are calling the shots, who are making the decisions in terms of hiring, in terms of, you know, making judgment. Otherwise, it would just, these things could be actually just, you know, almost like they're just incidents.
But one of the things we could look to as a way of predicting is looking at what young people think. And you teach younger people, at least younger than me, which is not difficult to get younger than me. What are they saying? You must have discussions in class about what's happened the last few weeks.
Absolutely. But I have to tell you, UCSB happened to be one of the most liberal campuses. And therefore, of course, my student, men and women, you know, of all the different colors, and we happen to have a very diverse student body. Basically, they are almost collectively that are progressive, and they are certainly, you can say, disgusted by the current Washington politics. And they are almost, you know, many of them, if they could, they probably will vote for, you know, neither Trump nor Clinton. There will be this, you know, Sanders that they will be more interested in there. And so these people are now seeking change in their own way. They would, you know, they form their own organized action. They try to do their own part. They try to do something. They're angry. They try to do something. And, you know, so this is kind of a movement emerging right now, but we don't know what it is yet.
How do you account for women and women with daughters, and men with daughters too, ignoring people's behavior against women? I mean, to me, you know, the whole Trump experience, and even today with Alabama, you hear women on television say, yeah, but, you know, I like the other one. I like Moore's politics. But how can a woman or a woman with a daughter not be enraged. That, you know, if you're going to have a seminal change, you really need the women to be on the forefront.
Yeah, you know, certainly that seemed to be very puzzling. But, you know, I did study a little bit about media effect. You know, people nowadays are very polarized. And they listen to the radio, watch them, you know, read things that they like, they can identify with. And therefore, they are tone deaf to the other voices. So even if there are all these, you know, counter evidence about what thou should do, thou should not, whatever, but they just couldn't listen. They couldn't absorb. That's the kind of mind block that we are facing right now. It's very, very unfortunate.
And in order to make change, at least in our generation, change is coming. I mean, the younger people are totally, I don't think it's just UCSB. I mean, younger people have a completely different view. All the polls show of social issues. But in order to make change quickly, you really need to get people to stop listening to themselves, an echo chamber, and really think about the social price they're paying to have people who are, this is not, you know, someone acting stupidly. These are people who are, you know,
strategically
using power to control other people. And that's, you know, the precursor to a dictatorship. So anyway, so by the way, when you were criticizing people for listening to radio, it's not AM 1290 KZSB. We are a totally different type of radio station where if you listen to us, you will be wise afterwards. You're listening to AHA Presents About Education on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back.
Available only at the company's headquarters in Goleta, the new Deckers brand showcase features the latest footwear from UGG, Teva, Sanuk, Hoka, and Ahnu brands. You're invited to stop by to experience firsthand what makes Deckers brand so unique. Discover new product and try on a range of offerings from your favorite Deckers brand at their retail stores. Now open to the public 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. Monday through Saturday and from 11 to 5 on Sunday at 250 Coramore Drive in Goleta.
In 1962, Pierre Lafond founded the first post-prohibition commercial winery in Santa Barbara County. In 1972, he planted his first vineyard in the San Ynez Valley west of Buellton and later hired legendary winemaker Bruce McGuire to continue to build on the stellar reputation that Santa Barbara Winery has achieved for more than 50 years. Today, you're invited to experience the award-winning wines at Santa Barbara Winery at the corner of Yananali and Anacapa and the Lafond Winery at 6855 Santa Rosa Road in Buellton.
Habitat for Humanity of Southern Santa Barbara County is building strength, stability, and self-reliance through shelter. Habitat has completed construction on 19 new homes for affordable homeownership. We'll build 3 new affordable homes this spring and has repaired over 35 homes through the A Brush with Kindness program. To learn more about how you can support Habitat by volunteering, donating, or shopping at the Habitat Restore, visit sbhabitat.org or call 692-2226. Here's a question. Do you enjoy experiencing the best of Santa Barbara? Tasty restaurants, scenic hiking, local banking experts. That's right, local banking experts. Montecito Bank and Trust was voted best bank again by the Santa Barbara Independent, Santa Barbara News Press, and San Ynez Valley News Readers. Plus, they have over 40 years of experience, 10 branches from Solvang to Westlake, a convenient on-the-go mobile banking app, and a savvy team of local decision makers. Visit Montecito.bank today. Montecito Bank and Trust, member FDIC.
Welcome back to AHA Presents About Education. AHA, using innovative social-emotional learning and character building to help teens. I'm Neil Kreisel, and I'm here today with Peta Liam, a professor of political science at UCSB, and we are here today to solve all problems related to gender, women, and discrimination. So we better get going because we only have three quarters of the show left, and it's a big topic.
Yes. Okay.
Let's just step back a second and talk about Asian American people. They have had a journey that's somewhat different from other people in America. What are the distinguishing elements of that experience?
Yes. Okay. It actually can talk about either both historical time, I would say prior to 1965 or afterwards. So I will talk about both if we have enough time. Yeah. But let's talk about something happened before that is make Asian American very different. Before means beginning with 1882, which is the very nation's very first Immigration Exclusion Act, targeting particularly Chinese, that anybody of Chinese descent cannot move into this country. The man or woman, for whatever reason, with a few exceptions, because of the, you know, you can say xenophobia and whatever at that time. It was the nation's very first Immigration Exclusion Act and targeting a particular group. But with the Chinese, anti-Chinese sentiment that actually prevailed over to other Asians, or blocking other Asian Americans from Asian immigrants from entering this country. But practically, there was certainly the history, you know, goes through, you know, depending on which country you're talking about, there is some kind of up and down. But basically, prior to 1965, Asian American were severely suppressed in terms of their ability to come to this country. It was during that 1960s, along with the passage of the Voting Rights Act, you know, the Civil Rights Act, and therefore we also have this Immigration Reform Act. It was actually only at that time that Asian American were given the equal chance of entering this country.
Okay, so let's just step back. Before we get post-1965,
right.
If I remember my history, Chinese labor was a substantial part of building the railroads, building the West. So people did get in.
Yes, okay. So thank you for reminding me of that, or everybody of that. Okay, so Chinese were actually originally recruited, invited in because of their labor. And we need them, right, to first of all go to the gold mines. And then later on, when the mines were gone, and they go to the railroad, building the transcontinental railroad in California, right, and in Nevada. Actually, when I was in Utah, we actually go to this promontory point. That's where that we have this the east and western part of the transcontinental railroad joint. There was a Golden Spike, actually, national monument. And actually, because I'm the Chinese, so I went with the group, and they were there actually say that we want to do a reenactment of what happened on May 10th. And because there was not a single Chinese appear in a photo of a celebration photo of the Golden Spike, you know, ceremony. And so the reenactment by the organization of Chinese American at that time, which I was a member, is actually that slowly dress up and then with Chinese faces to say that no, the justice, you know, give our ancestors the justice in terms of their fair share of the recognition of their contribution to the building of the American West.
So when you went to school in Taiwan as a young girl and you had, I assume, some American history, how did they know? No American history? They didn't teach you? They didn't discuss these issues about how they were treated, how Chinese people were treated in America? Taiwan?
Not at all. Not at all. Actually, yeah. I don't. Okay, let me tell you. When I entered, you know, in the U.S., you need to check boxes in terms of who you are, right, in terms of your racial origin and whatever. So when I first entered, I don't know which box to check. I don't even know that I'm an Asian. Because, you know, so back in Taiwan, when I actually completed my education until college graduation, actually, so I have a complete education in Taiwan, and I have not learned anything about my race. Because that society was considered homogenous, right? It's all Chinese. There's no need to talk about race or racial differences when everybody is considered the same. I would say considered. That means society doesn't recognize any kind of differences. It was also an authoritarian state at that time.
But did they teach any American history and to look at the experience that this homogenous race had in America? Did that come up in education at all?
Not okay. Let me also tell you that I was actually an English major.
Oh.
Okay, so we were required to learn a lot of it's foreign languages and literature actually, rather than the English. But you know, it just but mostly it's about English anyway. And so perhaps that major also didn't actually go too much into about this. Actually, yeah, you would think that we would, but actually we didn't. Well, we were required to learn the Chinese history and all other things, but maybe my memory is not that good, but I don't remember, actually, before I come to the United States, that I learned anything about America other than what I maybe capture something from the media, from the TV shows, you know, Western shows, actually, at that time. I remember Leave It to Beaver, you know, things like those, actually.
No, you're too young to remember Leave It to Beaver, aren't you?
Thank you very much. Maybe it's a rerun, right?
Yeah, it's a rerun. So you ended up studying in America, and so even though you didn't have American history,
right,
you were interested in coming to America, and that's because of the educational system, or you just saw the cowboys and Indians running around. What was the reason that brought you all the way here?
Okay. There's actually a political reason. Okay, the political reason is actually, even if I was born and raised in Taiwan, but my parents actually were born and raised in China. And then they have to fled, you know, their homeland. And then, they were stranded, actually, in Taiwan, because they came to Taiwan for higher education. And then 1949 came, and they couldn't return to their, you know, own country, their own homeland, actually. So my family, because of that background, I'm not the kind of Taiwanese, considered by the Taiwanese, and they were considered demanders. And because of that, my parents would like me to, to come to the U.S. because the U.S. is actually the most popular, the only country we know, actually, that because we see other people all coming, and that they would like me to come and get an education and a job, maybe even a status, so that just in case something happened in Taiwan, I am their security blanket. Mm-hmm. I'm their deposit.
Mm-hmm. But interesting that they chose America without that much real understanding of what America was.
Well, that's what, you know, that's kind of, it's an American dream, right? We dream, we don't even need to know. We don't want to know. We just like to know there's hope, right? There's something that you will be successful, or that you will, you hope to be successful, to be a much better life, more secure life.
It's funny because we talk about TV shows. I met some Russians a few years ago who moved here, and they said that their experience with America was watching the soap opera Santa Barbara in Russia. So, you know, sometimes TV is very important. You chose to go to University of Michigan, which
right.
is a very good school, and that's because of the football program, correct?
Actually, I know nothing about football. Actually, the reason is because it's a completely different environment than I came from an island that's almost like Santa Barbara, right? There's no seasonal differences. It's all spring. And so in Taiwan, you can also say that it's a spring season. I want to go to a place that's real weather, four seasons. So therefore, Michigan is one of those.
Excuse me, today is summertime. It's 93 today. So thank you for wishing that we have three seasons. I like to go back to the boring 71. When I moved here, I remember watching the weather, and they were serious. They said, well, here's the weather for the next 7 days. It's going to be 71 and 72 tomorrow, and then it's going to go to 73. And then back to, like, they were talking about it like it made a difference. You're listening to AHA Presents About Education on the Santa Barbara News Press radio station. We'll be right back.
For more than 20 years now, the unique landscape and people of the Santa Barbara community have helped grow Deckers brands into the lifestyle footwear leaders they are today. Newly opened at their headquarters in Goleta, the Deckers brand showcase allows you to explore and shop the UGG, Teva, Sanuk, Hoka, and Ahnu brands while you're likely to discover something new or potentially receive an in-store special offer. At 250 Coromar Drive in Goleta, the showcase is open to the public 10 a.m. to 7 Monday through Saturday and 11 to 5 on Sunday.
Celebrating 50 years of serving loyal regular guests and first-time visitors, the Pierre Lafond Market and Deli invites you to enjoy their huge selection of fresh-baked sweets, cookies, carrot cake, muffins, and the famous farm cake, granola, Oreo popcorn, wine cake, homemade soups, and the popular fresh juice bar. Or get a coffee drink or fresh-squeezed juice and peruse the famous wall of greeting cards at the Pierre Lafond Market and Deli. Open 6 a.m. to 8 p.m. daily in the Plaza del Sol, Montecito Village.
Habitat for Humanity of Southern Santa Barbara County is building strength, stability, and self-reliance through shelter. Habitat has completed construction on 19 new homes for affordable homeownership.
Will built 3 new affordable homes this spring and has repaired over 35 homes through the A Brush with Kindness program. To learn more about how you can support Habitat by volunteering, donating, or shopping at the Habitat Restore, visit sbhabitat.org or call 692-2226. Here's a question. Do you enjoy experiencing the best of Santa Barbara? Tasty restaurants, scenic hiking, local banking experts. That's right, local banking experts. Montecito Bank and Trust was voted best bank again by the Santa Barbara Independent, Santa Barbara News Press, and San Ynez Valley News Readers. Plus, they have over 40 years of experience, 10 branches from Solvang to Westlake, a convenient on-the-go mobile banking app, and a savvy team of local decision makers. Visit Montecito.bank today. Montecito Bank and Trust, member FDIC.
Welcome back to AHA Presents About Education. AHA, Improving Attitude, Creating Social Harmony, Bridging the Achievement Gap for Teens. I'm Neil Kreisel, and I'm here today with Peta Liam, a professor of political science at UCSB. And during the break, we were talking about the paradox of the internment camps in Utah for the Japanese. We talked about Utah because Peta actually, that was her first step before Michigan, was Utah. We can talk about that in a minute. But the thing I find really quite perplexing is that we were interning Japanese because we were afraid that they may be spies or troublemakers, and yet we had people of Japanese descent in the serving in the military winning honors.
Right.
So what's that all about?
Well, okay. A little bit correction. Actually, prior to arriving at Santa Barbara, I was teaching at University of Utah. And that's right. It's a little bit more recent experience. Okay. But in Utah.
How does Utah compare to Santa Barbara? Which is nicer?
Both are beautiful places. That's what people say. Hey, you like to move to beautiful places. I said, yes, I do. Yes. That place actually also has very four clear seasons. that which one is better? I would say I like both. Okay, so back to the Japanese-American issue. Actually, so in Utah, I happen to, part of my job is actually to teach ethnic studies. Mm-hmm. So I had the liberty and the luxury actually to study a lot of history before I shared that with my student, mm-hmm. because I never learned it in school. Remember, actually, my PhD degree is in poli sci and in Florida. At that time, none of my courses also had anything to do with racial minority politics of Asian American politics. So everything is all I learned. Fortunately, people write books for me to learn. Mm. So in Utah, we have the internment camp. I was able to visit it. I actually, my direct boss, actually, she is actually, one of the survivors. Her family were interned, and they came from California, then they stayed in Utah, and they moved to Salt Lake City. Okay, that's where I met her. So the Japanese Americans, those were 90% of them who were in the West Coast area, the California, Arizona, Washington, Oregon, these 90% of them, they were required, right, to be relocated to inland area. Utah is just one of the states. But two-thirds of them were actually born in the USA, therefore they were citizens, mm-hmm. okay? And the one-third who were born in Japan, they were not allowed to become citizens. Because, we mentioned something about the Chinese Exclusion Act. Not only Chinese were not welcome, but also they were prohibited from becoming naturalized citizens. And similarly, that trickled down, I guess, to the Japanese immigrants. Okay, and so even though two-thirds of them were the U.S. citizens, but they were kind of U.S.-born, and they were second generation and third generation, they're young in age. Okay, and these people, they were not able to vote. Right, they were not able to vote. Therefore, they don't have that political voices. So these people were being relocated, or quote unquote relocated, in the inland areas. Okay, and then simultaneously, in the nations, there is actually a particular state also the last state to join the union, this Hawaii. Okay, in Hawaii. Japanese American actually, at least about 40% of the population, the largest Asian American population, they were not interned. Okay, even though the Pearl Harbor, right? They were closest to there. But somehow they were not. Okay, but those Japanese who were actually, you know, at that time were serving in the U.S. UN military, they were actually, you know, they were dismissed actually from their job. So somehow their loyalty is still being questioned. Okay, and so Japanese American basically would be, as you said, that they will be suspected of their loyalty. They will be suspected of they committing some kind of espionage things because of they're guilty by ethnicity, guilty by, you know, by association, okay? Even though later on there were Supreme Court cases basically being overturned. Those basically affirming the kind of the judges would like to say that Japanese American guilty, but they were cases actually of Japanese American, almost like test cases that were done in the 1943, and then they were actually overturned in the 1986, in the 1980s, okay? And it's because of that, therefore, Japanese internment, you know, entire thing would actually overturn. The guiltiness actually was unfounded. Our government actually were found to fabricate it and falsify the document in order to commit those Japanese Americans. And so this is the sort of a redress act. Eventually, this is a remarkable story of a wrong population in the U.S. nation history. We were able to receive justice. We receive apologies. We receive compensations, limited compensations, whatever the wrong they suffer from. So this is actually the only American redress story, actually. It's a successful redress story. So that's one of the uniqueness, actually, of the Japanese-American, also Asian-American history.
So what makes culturally, all Asians so able to adapt and succeed? You know, you look at the Vietnamese boat people. They came here, and within one generation, they own half of California. You look at all of the good private schools where I came from, New York. Top kids are always Asian.
Right.
What is in the Asian culture that permits them? Are they just smarter than us, or are they just more motivated? Why do they succeed so quickly?
Well, of course, I would say, yeah, we work hard, okay? But this is actually something about the value of education, the centrality of education, why, you know, education is considered the instrument, the mechanisms to succeed, to overcome all these barriers. We can mention racial, gender, whatever, but we would say influenced actually by the Confucian, Confucianism about education being the social model. The factor that could help you propel to success, to actually in elected office, in offices, not elected office, but in governmental positions, in, you know, business, you know, world as well. So it's that kind of a commitment to excel in education. They believe in, this is almost like they believe in the utility of it, the goodness that will come from it, the rewards of education. Therefore, we're willing to invest in that. And that becomes a very important one. Whether or not it's cultural, I'm not sure. But certainly it does involve some kind of hard work, some kind of commitment to want to spend that time and to put in all the resources to go to the best school, to even go to the cram school in order to help get the good grade and exam grade in order to be admitted to good schools and then to get a good job and whatever.
And does that commitment extend to politics? Do Asian Americans vote?
Haha, that's also a very interesting question because I always have debate about people. You know, if you look at the numbers, only 1/3 of the adult of 18 years and old who are eligible to vote, they actually vote. So from this is actually the lowest in the nation. You would say, oh yeah, that's evidence that Asian Americans do not vote. Okay, but I would say that, well, wait a minute. So you know Asian American also has the nation's highest foreign-born rate. We're talking about 2/3 of them were born abroad, and they cannot have something called birthright citizenship. In order to vote, you not only need to be registered to vote, but also you need to have U.S. citizenship. And so we are talking about the three steps here, right? The third step is that you actually turn out to vote, okay? And so because of the limitations by the citizenship requirement as well as by the pre-registration requirement, these are things that natural-born Americans do not usually face or know, or they do not question the value of this. And so these layers actually help explain the lowest voting rates. However, if you look at people who are eligible, citizens, adults, and also registered to vote. Actually, Asian American not as able to turn out to vote as the other American, including non-Hispanic white American. So that is, you know, so the story is not that straightforward, but certainly looking among the eligibles, Asian are not assured of the ability to vote.
What about the broader group? You are teaching about not just Asians, but other minorities, if you will, women,
right.
People of color.
Right.
There are differences in voting participation among that group.
Right.
How do you motivate people who are in who should be voting because
uh-huh.
it's in their own interest? And some of the voting percentages are dismal for people that really needed to vote last time.
Right.
How do you motivate people who feel they don't have an investment in the system to go out and vote?
Well, I almost had a feeling that because of the 2016 result, people should know clearly that voting has consequences, right? Whether you vote or you didn't vote, there is a result. And then whether you like or not like the result actually is probably will motivate you to say, I want to change that. If I want to change it, you need to put in something. So when people do not like the outcome, maybe it was other people's vote, but then they want to do something. And so it's actually the outcome. What do you want to get? What do you want from the political system? That would be they need to justify. They need some justification in terms of why do I want to spend my time there? So I thought that's, you know, to raise the awareness, to make that linkage between the policy impact or even direct impact of their lives and elected officials and who you are going to vote into, and to try to make that linkage, that will make them more interested in wanting to even just want to become citizens, become registered so that they can vote.
So in your experience, these groups do follow the politics. They just may not be as motivated, but they do follow. What's going on?
Well, to an extent, also depending on what type of politics. Immigrant community usually are more interested in homeland politics, the politics that happen, you know, back home, their country of birth, compared to U.S. politics. And then in U.S. politics, we're also talking about different levels of politics, and Washington is very far away. And so most of the time, indeed, people are kind of confused in terms of our system here. But then when there's certain issues, such as immigration, right, that suddenly, or even education, affirmative action, right, that would definitely motivate people, Asian American, when they know the consequences of the decision. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you kind of need to put in the interest there to engage the interest.
You're listening to AHA Presents About Education on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back.
Available only at the company's headquarters in Goleta, the new Deckers brand showcase features the latest footwear from UGG, Teva, Sanuk, Hoka, and Ahnu brands. You're invited to stop by to experience firsthand what makes Deckers brand so unique. Discover new product and try on a range of offerings from your favorite Deckers brand at their retail stores. Now open to the public 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. Monday through Saturday and from 11 to 5 on Sunday at 250 Coramar Drive in Goleta.
You're invited to dine indoors or on the secluded garden patio, the sunny patio, or the covered creekside patio with fireplace at Pierre Lafon's Montecito Wine Bistro, where you'll enjoy the popular pizzas and many other dishes from the wood-burning oven, daily specials from Chef Victor, and selections from the elevated wine menu featuring Lafon and Santa Barbara Winery wines. Open daily at 11 for lunch, wine, cocktails, dinner, incredible desserts, and a daily happy hour from 3 to 6 with very unique appetizers, in the Plaza del Sol, Montecito Village.
Habitat for Humanity of Southern Santa Barbara County is building strength, stability, and self-reliance through shelter. Habitat has completed construction on 19 new homes for affordable homeownership. We'll build 3 new affordable homes this spring and has repaired over 35 homes through the A Brush with Kindness program. To learn more about how you can support Habitat by volunteering, donating, or shopping at the Habitat Restore, visit sbhabitat.org or call 692-2226. Here's a question. Do you enjoy experiencing the best of Santa Barbara? Tasty restaurants, scenic hiking, local banking experts. That's right, local banking experts. Montecito Bank and Trust was voted best bank again by the Santa Barbara Independent, Santa Barbara News Press, and San Ynez Valley News Readers. Plus, they have over 40 years of experience, 10 branches from Solvang to Westlake, a convenient on-the-go mobile banking app, and a savvy team of local decision makers. Visit Montecito.bank today. Montecito Bank and Trust, member FDIC.
Welcome back to AHA Presents About Education. I'm Neil Kreisel, and we're here today with Peta Liam, a professor of political science at UCSB. And we've been talking about race, we've been talking about gender, but your title is professor of political science. First of all, how did you choose political science?
Okay. Well, the straight answer is that I did not really choose political science, or at least that was not my first choice. I have been dreaming to become somebody like you who was able to do broadcasting, someone was able to kind of report in the news that can influence other people, even though my college major was actually English. But that English major was also not really my choice because, you know, in the system that I came from, it's very competitive. And I basically had the good enough score to go to the very best university, very best, the top ranked department. So that was out of vanity, I guess. So it was really not a choice that I got into where I am. So therefore, I kind of, okay, so when I had a choice, when I moved to the U.S., I thought, yes, I want to live my dream. I really like journalism. You know, at that time, our college, my university, which is National Taiwan University, also did not actually have a department called journalism. Mm-hmm. You know, it was considered pseudoscience. Mm-hmm. You know, you are either humanities or you are social sciences, but where's journalism? It's sort of in between, okay? Right. But I like it anyway. So I got a master's degree in mass communication and journalism. And then I told my professor, you know, as immigrants, I really need a higher degree in order to get a job. And my professor in journalism, and he said that, you are not you don't have the professional experiences. You want to be the very good journalist, not just any kind of social reporters. I suggest, actually, that you move to another major. You probably get another degree. Then you probably have a better chance of finding a good job. And so I look around, and so the College of Social Sciences, Letter and Sciences was next to it. So I thought, okay, sociology or political science. I'm also into public opinion. I'm actually very interesting learning about what people think and in a large scale. And so in journalism, you do that kind of, right? Ask three people, right? And then you get something. But in political science, so I understand is actually you actually do polling. You actually had a lot more scientific way of asking people and learn something about what they think. And so I decided I want to go to political science because I like to do survey. I like to do public opinion survey. And I happened to find a professor that seemed to be famous and that she said, yeah, she's okay to accept me, even though I do not really have the political science background, right, to study PhD, actually. So I'm only political scientist because I got a PhD in political science.
So that's a great recommendation for people who go to school. Just take something that you can get a PhD in, and then you can do whatever you want afterwards. I'm thinking of becoming a medical doctor so I can park without having being afraid of getting a ticket.
Yeah. Yeah, basically, I would say that some of our students were also afraid of choosing majors or choosing the wrong majors. First of all, do not be afraid of making changes if you do not think it will work. Secondly, even if you do not start with the political science or whatever they end up with until the PhD degree, you can still be successful. I believe I'm pretty successful as a political scientist, even if I really have a very thin background.
But a lot of the courses, some of the courses you teach could also be taught in gender studies and in other parts of the university?
I would think so, yes.
Yeah. And who takes your course? I mean, what is a typical student interested in who's a student of yours?
Okay. Well, I think our students take the course that is still had openings rather than whether or not.
But those that are real, those that choose it because they want to learn something. What is their motivation?
Oh, okay. They want to learn something. And certainly a few students, they would say it's because of me, right? Because as I said, our campus was relatively diverse, actually. So we definitely have Asian students, one-fourth of them. Another one-fourth of them are actually Latino students. Mm-hmm. So I am an immigrant woman of color. Right. And so students want to find some identification. I'm the one who can address immigration issues, gender issues, the intersection of race and gender issues. And somebody who come from outsider background. I'm also a returning student, actually. And I'm more an adult student compared to others who have a very smooth role. Therefore, I feel like I can inspire. And I'm more sympathetic, actually, to people who have alternative background and to tell them that it's OK. You can still be successful even if you started late. I'm a late boomer as well. Mm. So
and there are white males in your class too, though?
Okay, they are. But I have to tell you, indeed, I sometimes had to begin the class or at least put in my syllabus saying that this professor is progressive. Right? And I put in the syllabus saying there, and some of the topics that we are discussing may be uncomfortable to you, I would like you to know this, but I would like you to respect the differences, just to learn to listen, and so that we all can learn from each other, that I will never penalize students that are disagreeing with me in terms of ideology or policy position or something. I just want people to be able to express it and to justify what they think their stance is, public policy stance or whatever issues. And so I respect the differences, and I think that's very important. But I hope the student understand I definitely actually were not penalizing students no matter which side of politics they are, even though I told them I have a clear progressive side of politics.
Well, after I moved out here, I had retired, but I decided to go teach, and I taught at City College for 12 years. I taught finance and investments, and I began the class with the following statement. I said, I think if you're taking an economics course or a finance course, you really need to know what the political leanings of the professor is, because politics is part of understanding economics, because there's a difference of opinion. And I said, I'm very liberal. And one time someone got up and left, which is okay, but they didn't want to hear they didn't want someone with a filter that is to the left learning about economics. So that's why I asked about, you know, white men taking your course. Does anyone just say, well, this isn't for me?
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, some of them have to take my course even if they think that's not for them. You know, remember, I also teach at University of Utah. Probably many people think that it's one of the most conservative, most white institutions. So actually, I learned to kind of protect my own positions from that extreme environment. But definitely, even though I said most of the students are quite liberal and, you know, that the understanding of the differences, but not all of them, and when you talk about white males, right, even those identity, and they just do not like the label. But I explained to them, no, you actually have the option to not identify that way. And then I'm actually not targeting individuals. I'm talking about a system, a white supremacist racial order that we inherited, you know, from our history. Okay, so I'm not targeting any individuals, but we need to understand that in order to break it down.
One of the things, I guess, in higher education now is trigger points where you need to tell the students what's going to happen so you don't trigger some anxiety. And I guess in a sense that's required in your courses too, because identity and race and gender, it does bring up some profound feelings among people.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that could be a good and bad thing, as you probably understand.
Yeah.
And so, we try to make them feel comfortable and knowing that it's okay. You are entitled to your feelings, and we are all part of the learning process, and dialogue is very important. Interaction is very important, and that's why I always ask people to write response papers to tell us what they think.
You're listening to AHA Presents About Education, and we'll be right back with our final segment, believe it or not.
Founded by a UCSB grad, Deckers Brands has grown into a global driver of lifestyle footwear from humble beginnings in 1973. Santa Barbara has been a key element of the business, defining the company's culture, providing home base for many employees, and inspiring product innovation each year. For a first-hand experience, stop by the Deckers Brands headquarters in Goleta, 250 Coromar Drive, from 10 to 7, Monday through Saturday, 11-5 Sunday, and shop their new brand showcase retail test lab. Guaranteed, you'll see a new side to Deckers portfolio, from footwear to handbags to home furnishings.
In 1962, Pierre Lafond founded the first post-prohibition commercial winery in Santa Barbara County. In 1972, he planted his first vineyard in the San Ynez Valley west of Buellton, and later hired legendary winemaker Bruce McGuire to continue to build on the stellar reputation that Santa Barbara Winery has achieved for more than 50 years. Today, you're invited to experience the award-winning wines at Santa Barbara Winery at the corner of Yananali and Anacapa, and the Lafond Winery at 6855 Santa Rosa Road in Buellton.
Habitat for Humanity of Southern Santa Barbara County is building strength, stability, and self-reliance through shelter. Habitat has completed construction on 19 new homes for affordable homeownership. We'll build 3 new affordable homes this spring and has repaired over 35 homes through the A Brush with Kindness program. To learn more about how you can support Habitat by volunteering, donating, or shopping at the Habitat Restore, visit sbhabitat.org or call 692-2226.
Here's a question. Do you enjoy experiencing the best of Santa Barbara? Tasty restaurants, scenic hiking, local banking experts. That's right, local banking experts. Montecito Bank and Trust was voted best bank again by the Santa Barbara Independent, Santa Barbara News Press, and San Ynez Valley News Readers. Plus, they have over 40 years of experience, 10 branches from Solvang to Westlake, a convenient on-the-go mobile banking app, and a savvy team of local decision makers. Visit Montecito.bank today. Montecito Bank and Trust, member FDIC.
Welcome back to AHA Presents About Education. AHA helps teens manage their emotions, support their peers, and serve their community. We're here today with Peta Liam, a professor of political science at UCSB. And one of the many things that the professor has done is to form a group called the Asian Pacific American Caucus. So tell us about that.
Oh, okay. Because I came in as a political scientist and studying something about racial and ethnic politics, something called minority politics, even in political science as a field 20 years ago, this is actually a new topic. Okay. And most people, when they think of minority politics, they think of black politics. At that time, they don't even think of Latino politics. But fortunately, there's some Latino politics. And then what about Asian? I happen to have done a dissertation on Asian American politics, probably one of the nation's first, actually. And so I have the audacity to want to do that, but I want to have some affirmation. I want to have a place in our national conference program. And it was a very competitive process. And I learned, actually, that if you form a caucus as a related group of our national association, you are entitled to a one full panel in our national meeting program. And so, it was a very self-interested motivation, mm-hmm. and that I want to have a space in our national program so that you can have the audiences to present our scholarly work on Asian American. Therefore, I co-found the Asian American Caucus within the American Political Science Association back in 1999. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then forever, ever since we have been able to successful the presenting research on Asian American because of that. And later on, we also formed the Status Committee on Asian Pacific American in the political science discipline.
And what other groups do you work with?
Right. In addition to that status committee there, right? I also I'm actually pretty active also in a regional association called Western Political Science Association. I also found the Status Committee on Asian Americans. So this is, status committee basically is signaling by the association that we care about you guys. You are one of us, but you're also different. And we want to give you special attention, special panel allocation, special money actually to help you bring together scholarship so that we can, in our national gathering, we actually would like to listen and give you the kind of the research that you're doing. And so I was part of that. And currently I'm also part of the first generation scholars committee, which is among the American Political Science Association. This is only our second year in existence. We are doing this, we realize actually that not all the political scientists are the same. There are many differences, but particularly we have students and scholars and, of course, professors that are actually first generation. It could be first generation in the family studying in the United States, that including people like me, actually, because I also the first in the nation, first in my family, actually, to come to the U.S., even if I thought that I'm a little bit more privileged than others, because my parents actually also has some higher education, but it's not in this country. Okay, but we were aware of the first generation issues, and so I'm part of the team, that founding team, actually try to also help our association address these issues.
And what's so interesting is your journey and so many other Asian Americans is now being followed by people from Mexico and people of Hispanic descent, and they're having a really difficult time given the politics of it. So it's a very timely subject.
Yeah.
And it must touch a lot of your students.
Yes, actually, I would say I follow them. Actually, they are the one, you know, it's African-American. They follow the footstep of African-American scholars and then Latino scholars. We actually, Asian-American is a lot smaller population, a lot shorter history, you know, association. So we actually are following their footsteps and thank their generosity, actually sharing the experience with us in terms of how do you get a voice, get a seat at the table in order to be successful in our profession.
Thank you so much, Peta. It sounds like your courses would be wonderful to take.
You
mentioned you're Asian. I thought you were from New York originally.
But, oh, thank you.
you know, I guess that's not a New York accent, but I, you know, what do I know? Anyway, thank you so much. Have a great Thanksgiving. Thank you for listening to AHA Presents About Education. We'll be right back next week.
It's